Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Hello from the studios of the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed, your host. Today's topic, reporting on epidemics and pandemics. On a windy, dusty day in March, the company cook at Fort Riley, Kansas, reported to the camp infirmary with complaints of a bad cold. Right behind him came a corporal voicing similar complaints. By noon, the camp surgeon had over 100 sick men on his hands. Nearly 50 soldiers at Fort Riley died that spring, and no one knew why. That was the beginning of the Spanish influenza of 1918. The infectious disease would kill more than 600,000 Americans, the worst epidemic this country has ever experienced. By October of that year, it had spread to become a worldwide pandemic and eventually infected about one-third of the world's population and killed more than 50 million people. Influenza is one of many pandemics that have wiped out large populations of the civilized world through the centuries. Smallpox and tuberculosis, typhus and cholera. The Asian flu in the late 50s killed 2 million worldwide, and the Hong Kong flu in the late 60s killed 1 million. More recent infectious diseases that have spread globally are the HIV pandemic and the H1N1 pandemic, or swine flu. H5N1, also known as bird flu or avian flu, came close to becoming a pandemic in recent years. The Spanish flu was similar in structure to the swine flu virus, although some scientists say it was more like avian flu. Influenza scientists and public health planners are prepared for the next big outbreak. They're preparing for the next big outbreak. They say it's a matter of time because flu viruses mutate constantly and can foil human immune systems quickly before there's time for mass immunizations. Will it be H5N1? 2 months ago, the UN Food and Agricultural Organization warned of a possible resurgence of the bird flu virus. The UN agency said the mutant strain of the H5N1 influenza can apparently sidestep defenses of existing vaccines, and it was spreading in China and Vietnam. To put this public health threat in perspective and to get behind-the-scenes insight on what it's like to report about epidemics and pandemics, we'll hear from four journalists with vast experience on this beat. Helen Branswell, she's a medical reporter for the Canadian Press, and her journalism career spans 3 decades. Branswell has covered SARS, avian influenza, swine flu, in the effort to eradicate polio. She recently completed a Nieman Global Health Fellowship at Harvard. Maggie Fox is a managing editor at the National Journal, directing technology and healthcare coverage. Before joining NJ, she was global health and science editor at Reuters, where she planned and managed coverage of the 2009 swine flu pandemic. Stephanie Friedhoff is a special projects manager at the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard. She's also a freelance journalist and science writer for U.S. and European media. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming. This is quite an illustrious crew. Donald McNeil, a science and health reporter for the New York Times, who specializes in, and this is the wording on his website, plagues and pestilences. He could not join us during the program, but during an interview earlier this week, he said the biggest challenge in covering dangerous diseases is, quote, the confusion and panic.
When there's an actual pandemic, the biggest problem is probably just the confusion and the panic and people coming up to you and grabbing your arm and saying, oh my God, are we all going to die? And not understanding how great the real risks are. Because people's moods change enormously. I mean, you saw that happen with swine flu, where in the beginning everybody was terrified of it. And then they all wanted vaccine as soon as it was available. And then as soon as the vaccine was available, which took several months, everybody completely lost interest and wasn't worried about it anymore. And so relatively few people got the shots, and the people who made the vaccine were stuck with millions of doses. And then, of course, the rest of the world needed the shots, but the United States and the other big countries had decided to keep enough shots for themselves, and then they never actually managed to get any of those shots to other countries.
Okay. Pandemics have been the subject of more than a dozen popular novels and a similar number of films. The latest is Contagion, a movie about a deadly and fast-moving virus and the doctors contracted by the Centers for Disease Control to deal with the outbreak. This is a trailer from Contagion.
Watch this. It's transmission, so we just need to know which direction.
On day one, there were two people, and then four, and then 16. In 3 months, it's a billion. That's where we're headed.
They're calling out the National Guard. They're moving the president underground.
People will panic.
Get away!
It will tip over.
The truth is being kept from the world.
Cook your samples, destroy everything.
Yes, McNeil, whether the movie is realistic.
Every disease is different, so it's a little hard to say what the reality is going to be. But I think many of the things they did in there were quite realistic. And the air of panic and false information and weird accusations that was characterized by Jude Law is definitely something that happens in pandemics. Now, it's usually not one all-powerful person that everybody listens to. There's usually lots of bloggers mouthing off about all sorts of things, and there's lots of crazy rumors and false reports one has to run down. But given what Hollywood does with reality, I thought they did a pretty good job.
Okay. Mr. McNeil also talked about the trickiness of definitions. He said, quote, "The minute you use the word pandemic, you really scare people." Maggie and Stephanie, you closely covered H1N1 in 2009. That might be a good example to talk about definitions, because I think there's still a discussion of whether that was actually a pandemic, and maybe explain what a pandemic is.
Oh, it was definitely a pandemic. This is Maggie. There's no doubt about it. A pandemic is the emergence of a new and serious disease that spreads around the world. It's a pretty broad definition. There's no doubt that H1N1 was a pandemic. What the definition doesn't include is how serious it was. And it ended up being not as deadly as people had feared, although it was actually quite a fairly deadly influenza and killed people who were outside the usual age range. Flu usually kills old people. This flu tended to kill younger people. So it was something new and serious. I have to respectfully disagree with Don that there was a lot of panic at the beginning. There might have been concern, but I think panic is a bit of a strong term. What do you think, Stephanie?
Yeah, I agree. I think the general population was certainly not panicked about this, but rather confused and looking for information.
Stephanie, you covered that. Before we get into that, could you talk a little bit about seasonal flu? I think that's a lot of people's minds right now. I know it's different for different parts of the world. The seasons are different. But can you talk about how seasonal flu fits into this bigger picture of epidemics and pandemics?
Maggie, do you want to take that?
Sure. I mean, we have seasonal flu all the time. It's around year-round, and there are several different strains. And as you mentioned in your introduction, the trouble with flu is that it mutates all the time. It's always changing so that your body can't develop permanent defenses against it. And that's why it's so hard to vaccinate against flu and why you have to vaccinate every year. Influenza is a fairly serious virus. In some people, it causes mild symptoms, but it's unpredictable. And perfectly healthy people can get very, very sick with the flu. It's confusing because there are so many viruses out there that cause flu-like symptoms, and people tend to call a lot of things flu. And doctors and scientists refer only to the influenza virus as flu. So people get mixed up too, and they think there's more disease around than there is, and that's where some of the questions about whether the vaccine is effective come from, because people will be vaccinated against influenza. They'll come down with another virus, and they'll say, oh, my gosh, this vaccine either didn't work, or they say the vaccine gave them the flu. So this all plays in. The pandemic flu, the H1N1 flu, actually came from seasonal flu. It was a combination of several different strains of flu that all kind of meshed together. Flu viruses not only mutate, but they can mix and match with one another. Sometimes people call it viral sex. They can actually exchange genes, and that's what happened with this one. It's kind of a Frankenstein monster that emerged from the original 1918 pandemic flu that you talked about, and then some of the other seasonal flu viruses that had been circulating since then.
Helen and Stephanie, if you want to, do you want to add anything on basically kind of setting the groundwork for people to understand these definitions and these diseases?
Stephanie, do you want to take a run at it?
Well,
go ahead.
Well, we could start. We could. In 2003, there were concerns about severe acute respiratory syndrome, SARS.
Right.
I know you guys covered that. Can you explain how that's different?
Well, SARS is different in that it was an entirely different disease. It was a new virus that had been probably living in bats for, who knows, millennia, and probably moved from bats into civet cats and then into people. It no longer circulates in people, so it's not an ongoing concern at this point. It certainly was quite scary at the time and caused quite a lot of global disruption.
Yeah, SARS is a great example of an emerging new disease. This is Maggie talking. Because it was this virus that came out of animals. It appears to have gotten into people through people eating these exotic animals, maybe these civet, which are it's kind of like a raccoon, and it's a delicacy in Southeast Asia. It was new. The body had no defenses against it, and this thing did exactly what scientists said a new virus would do. It flashed around the world, literally carried on jets, and you know, a few people who were infected managed to spread it to lots of other people. I think something like 8,000 people were infected before it was stopped, and 800 people died. It was stopped. Now, it's not clear whether the thing stopped because it just didn't have the momentum to spread globally, or whether because public health measures that were enforced at the time actually did work. You can never prove that you stopped a virus. But whatever, as Helen said, it just stopped.
Let me just add to that. Sorry, this is Stephanie speaking.
Hi, Stephanie.
This is a good example to help us understand that seasonal flu, the virus changes gradually, so most people have some immunity to most of the viruses that are going around, whereas the pandemic is when we have a new virus. And that's when we talk about sort of one of the major aspects of the definition of a pandemic. It's a new agent to which people have no immunity.
Okay, thanks. And anyone can answer this, and maybe we can talk about this a minute. What is the basic strategy of health organizations when confronted with a potential epidemic or pandemic? How the information and the action systems work.
There's actually a pretty good mechanism set up now. The World Health Organization has set up a big network of experts who kind of kick into action when there's a report. Usually everybody hears fairly quickly when there's the emergence of a new virus. For instance, H1N1, there was there's a screening and monitoring system that goes on all the time, and there were clinics at the border between the U.S. and Mexico where some kids had this funny-looking flu. People weren't sure what it was. It was sent to the labs, and it was immediately analyzed. Immediate in scientific terms means a couple of days or a couple of weeks, but it wasn't very long before people started exchanging information, trying to find out, A, what the virus was, B, how serious it was, and C, how widespread it was. And talk begins immediately about whether it's going to be possible to vaccinate against this virus, whether current vaccines work, whether a new vaccine will have to be designed. And people start sharing information. That's when all of us got busy, Helen, as I recall.
Helen and Stephanie, do you want to add anything to that for the general population?
Yeah, as Maggie was mentioned, there are systems in place. There's something called GFIN, which is a global public health information and network or something like that, that is managed by the WHO, and they monitor news releases and blogs and things from all over the world in a variety of different languages, looking for information that would indicate that there might be the emergence of a new disease. It's kind of like an early warning system. And when that picks up things, like, for instance, you mentioned SARS a few minutes ago. In early 2003, one of the things that was picked up, and it might actually have been late 2002, was that sales of vinegar were spiking in China. And in China, people use vinegar when there are diseases going around to try to clean. So that's the kind of clue that organizations like the WHO pick up on and start to investigate further when they materialize.
Stephanie, what's I understand it's a challenge for European journalists to cover the CDC. Can you talk about that?
Well, I would say that the tools that Helen has just mentioned have made it a lot easier. I think it is still clear that international journalists, not some Europeans, of course, if you're not working within the Anglo-American system, but certainly journalists from developed countries sometimes have a harder time getting through to people at the CDC. There's a number of barriers for colleagues from around the world.
Okay. Before we continue our discussion, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to today's program on our website. Please send us questions or comments via globaljournalistprogram@gmail.com or our Facebook page. For any of you, what are some of the best sources of information? You mentioned some of those for journalists, but what about non-journalists looking for information about contagious diseases?
There's a terrific newsletter that I subscribe to. I'm sure all three of us are subscribed to. That is interesting. It might have more technical information than the general public would want all the time, but it's called ProMed, and they monitor reports of disease outbreaks around the world and send you emailed updates about them. They have scientists who comment on the material in the report. So, for instance, if they picked up a story from the New York Times on, I don't know, a hand, foot, mouth outbreak somewhere, they would actually comment on the information contained in the report, and then other scientists sometimes respond. And it's a really interesting way to keep in touch with what's going on.
Okay.
This is Maggie. I know that Stephanie notes that people have trouble getting in touch with the CDC. The CDC, I think they're pretty aware of this. During something like a pandemic, they are besieged with phone calls. They've tried to improve their website, and I think they've done a pretty good job of making a very public-friendly website. If there's a breaking news story like the swine flu pandemic, they actually have a breaking box that you can just click on and get the latest information. They have an A to Z, so you can click on the name of any disease that you want to and read as deeply as you want. It kind of starts out being very general and gets very specific. But there are nice little advisories on what you can do to protect yourself and information about the vaccine and information about how many people have whatever disease it is that you're worried about.
Okay.
Yes, I mean, and you are right in that we have to acknowledge that the CDC is in a unique position here, because sometimes the CDC provides more information, is more besieged than even the WHO. So it becomes the world source of a lot of information. I guess this is also interesting to me, because we are now in an environment where we're no longer just reporting this for one audience in one country, but we're all consuming sort of the news and the reports that are going out in other nations too. And those are often countries where the journalists do not have access to information from their own health authorities, so they contact the CDC because that's where they can get learn more than in their own system.
Just a real basic question. How do you contact the CDC, or how do you get to their website?
Well, their website is cdc.gov, www.cdc.gov.
Okay.
And on that website, there are contact details for various media spokespeople based on, or broken down by their speciality, but those are meant to be used by journalists.
Okay. How do you, with the movie Contagion still in my mind, how do you strike a balance between providing accurate coverage of an emerging disease without causing a panic?
My argument, this is Maggie, is that if you provide timely, accurate information, you're not going to cause a panic. People don't panic unless panic is the logical reaction. People actually are pretty logical, and they're fairly calm, and they're actually fairly slow to react to something like a new disease. In fact, people have started to be resistant to things like vaccines and even drugs, thinking that they can manage on their own. If journalists provide the information in an easy-to-understand manner, people aren't going to panic. I don't know what you think, Helen and Stephanie.
Sure, jump
well,
in.
This is Stephanie here. I think that we need to keep two things in mind. One is Maggie's earlier question about what actually is a pandemic. What is a panic? If you're in a pandemic, a panic can be a very logical reaction in terms of, you know, people are dying around me, I have to get out of here. When we're not yet in a pandemic, and this is important, I think, for anybody to understand that there are three phases to a pandemic. There's a before, there's a being in the pandemic, and then there's an after. But I think most of the confusion and the discussion around panic arises when we're in the before, when we don't know yet if there will be a pandemic or sort of there's very mild symptoms. That's when we can sort of go overboard in one direction or the other to say, oh, it's nothing, or, you know, hundreds of people are going to die.
Okay. What kind of mistakes do non-healthcare reporters typically make when covering epidemics and pandemics that you've noticed?
Well, people mix up things. I mean, some of the terms can be very technical. People can easily mix up bacteria and viruses. They can easily confuse whether a virus can be treated with antibiotics. I mean, that's an everyday problem in U.S. healthcare especially. People think antibiotics can treat everything. People don't understand how vaccines work, and they're afraid of vaccines. They tend to think that the vaccine's more dangerous than the disease. People are worried that the drugs are not safe as well. And those confusions can spill over into the reporting. Journalists are also trained to look for the tension, to look for the dispute. And it's real easy to exaggerate tensions and disputes in reporting on anything medical. And it's one of the things all of us struggle with, because in your classical journalism training, you're told to look for that. Look for where there is confrontation or disagreement, because that's where the news is. It's not always that case in medicine, and sometimes people might be tempted to manufacture it when it's not there. I think Helen and Stephanie both have experienced that.
I wanted to pick up on what Meg just said, because I think it's really crucial. When you're covering something that's unfolding in real time, the information changes. You know, even the scientists are learning about what's happening. For instance, with SARS, no one knew anything about it at the beginning because it hadn't been a disease in humans before. So some of the declarations that were made in the early days of SARS turned out not to be true. It was thought initially that it was highly infectious. Turned out that was not the case. It did not spread well outside of hospitals. And so as the scientists learned that, they corrected themselves. But sometimes journalists see, as Maggie pointed out, when you're looking for the tension, sometimes journalists take a look at something like that and say, oh, you know, you said this before, and now you're saying this. There must be something nefarious going on here, when in actual fact, all it is science self-correcting. And, you know, if journalists don't understand that, there's the risk that they'll play up something that doesn't actually deserve to be played up.
Okay. Stephanie, the number of reporters covering the healthcare beat has declined. What's the impact of that dynamic?
On the flu story? Or
on just in general, health, you know, experts, reporters, who the number of reporters covering the healthcare beat has declined in newsrooms.
Well, I think the obvious immediate effect is that you don't have the conversations in the newsroom that we're having right now. You have two excellent, very well-educated reporters on the show here. And when the pandemic happens, and I'm sure Maggie and Helen can talk about this, there are conversations in the newsroom. Some editors will push and say, you know, no, we need to do the story this way. And then the reporter will have a lot of good arguments as to why she thinks the way Helen just articulated. No, it's just science self-correcting.
Okay.
It's not what you think it is.
Okay, Stephanie, I have to cut us off now. I'm sorry that we've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist. I'd like to thank Donald McNeil of the New York Times and the guest journalists who joined us today, Maggie Fox of the National Journal, Stephanie Friedhoff of the Nieman Foundation, and Helen Branswell of the Canadian Press. You guys were excellent, and it was a very good show. I appreciate you joining us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks for having us, indeed.
Okay. Our director is Joe Deutschman. Pat Akers engineered the audio. Raymond Tungekar is our executive producer. Mao Ling Zhang and Hojong Kim and Emily Kaiser are the lead producers for this show, assisted by Jessica Popovac and Ryan Kress. Thank you for listening and watching our program. And stay tuned for Free Press Watch.
And now, Free Press Watch, a segment on Global Journalist where each week we bring you a rundown of major events in press freedom from around the world. I'm Jessica Popovac. This week's reports come from the Committee to Protect Journalists and Wire Services. On Wednesday, the offices of a satirical French newspaper were firebombed just hours after the paper announced they were inviting the Prophet Muhammad to supposedly guest edit next week's issue. The bombing took place in the middle of the night at the Parisian paper's offices. No one was injured. Despite ongoing denunciations by Muslim leaders and politicians, the paper's editor says he does not plan to change course. And in Syria, several journalists have been detained or have gone missing since mass unrest erupted there in March. This past week, two journalists and a political blogger were added to that list. Syrian authorities are neither confirming nor denying holding some of those missing reporters, and several have not been heard from since their disappearance. And in China, a Tibetan writer and editor, Jolep Dawa, has been sentenced without trial after spending more than 1 year in the custody of Chinese authorities. The charges against him have not been disclosed. For more information on these and other events affecting press freedom around the world, please visit our website at www.globaljournalist.org. Thanks so much for joining us this week on Global Journalist. See you next week.